bit under 1,000 yards, I guess.
And you were under the constant fire from the shore, I should think.
Well, they didn't bother us too much because the real target were the landing craft. So although they...
Could they be seen when you were sweeping?
Oh, Lord, yes. Oh, yes, it was full daylight by then.
Yeah. No, but I mean, they were in the water coming towards the beach as you were sweeping.
They were starting to. Mm-hmm. We were in shore of them as they assembled and were lowering their craft, and they actually passed us going in. We were still close in, doing lateral sweeps to make sure that the areas... there were two channels, or a thing called a... Well, there was an area about 5 miles off, mm-hmm. where all the ships assembled to lower their landing craft and that kind of thing. And then there were two channels into the beach mm-hmm. for the first wave of landing craft to get through the minefields. And then, after we had swept that, turned away, and the first wave of landing craft had gone in on Omaha Beach and on Utah Beach, we then had to sort of check sweep the area in between so that they could go in anywhere at all. Mm-hmm. And we were starting on that, the lateral sweeping, when the first assault craft were going in.
Was much aircraft coming over, German, I mean?
Oh, during the night there was a constant stream of aircraft, you see. There was tremendous bombing activity going on.
And that directed towards you, or...?
No, this was against all the shore installations.
No, were there any German aircraft against?
No, there were very few German aircraft around, none against us. I'm not sure that any of the bombers or parachute air gliders were attacked at that time, that night, in that area. So it wasn't until later on that German air activity started in a big way.
Yeah. Did you receive any casualties to men on board?
Or no, we didn't, in fact. I think... one ship was hit, but there were no casualties I can recall. Mm-hmm. And none of us were put out of action. None of us were mined. We exploded mines.
Well, how does one go about exploding mines? Is it bringing to the surface and firing with a gun as we see?
Well, yes, for moored mines. Mm-hmm. But the mines, we don't really know how many mines we cut going in. We knew that we'd passed through a minefield. But you didn't see them in any way. They drifted down on the tide. But occasionally... a mine will explode in the sweep. Mm-hmm. If the wire isn't cut properly, the mine gets dragged down and then perhaps it'll hit the sweep. So one or two like that. How many we actually cut, we haven't the faintest idea. Mm-hmm. And then after we'd finished our chore there, we anchored and waited until we told what to do next. And the communications of the task force were an absolute shambles. They were jammed. It took hours to get a message through, mm-hmm. and get a reply.
Were you in view of the Mulbergs being towed in?
Well, that was farther along. Mm-hmm. And we saw that later on, of course, but not that day. We were so engrossed with watching what was going on the beach with the Americans that...
Were you in binocular view of Omaha Beach?
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah. We were about 4 miles off, I suppose. Watch the bombardment. Yeah. The worst sight of all was in the first assault, which they tried with these amphibious tanks. They had canvas.
The
DD tanks. And it was really most distressing to watch them flopping off the ramp of the landing craft and just go goggle, goggle, goggle down to the bottom. And I think only about one that we saw got ashore. Yeah. And very few heads came bobbing up afterwards. So they didn't really get any reasonable force of tanks ashore until they actually... So the first wave of infantry landed without any tanks more to speak of. And it wasn't until that evening that they actually really got a lodgment. And as I recall this, they assembled about 12 or so of these big landing ship tanks, the very big ones. Mm-hmm. And they just drove them right up on the beach, which they weren't supposed to do, and the tanks just poured out of there. But it was a miserable place because it was a very steep slope. It wasn't actually a cliff. Utah was cliff, but this wasn't steep, cliff actually, but it was very steep. And it wasn't really territory where you could
fight from
by tanks. It was a case of the assault engineers and infantry just fighting their way up the slope. And as you know, they had the bad luck to run into a really first-class combat division on that in that area, which the others didn't. Mm-hmm. But I've been back a couple of times and looked at it from the shore end, and they look somewhat different. But I'm amazed that they actually chose that particular area. I think they probably hoped that the terrain was so, well, the beach terrain was so rugged that there might not have been the degree of hard defences that the others had.
But I suppose that position was a necessity almost if they wanted to.
You had to cover the whole area, yes. Yeah. Yes.
It's a shame.
So they had some pretty horrendous casualties there.
How soon did it take you to get orders? You were...
Oh, we didn't get orders till that evening. And then we had to go back and sweep a large field of moored mines that we'd skimmed the edge off going in. I think we swept something like 90-odd mines in that one over the next 2 days. Finished that, then we did another couple of small minefields that had been located in the area. And then we were kept there partly as on what was known as the Mason-Dixon line in the American area, which was a sort of defense line protecting the beach from E-boats, mm-hmm. anti-aircraft line, that kind of thing. There was a fair amount of air activity, but we didn't see any E-boats, although E-boats were quite active in the area. Mm-hmm. We never actually saw any, or at least not well enough to fire at. So by then, and then along came the gale, which completely destroyed the American Mulberry, mm-hmm. and that was quite horrendous. It lasted about 3 days, and it was disappointing to watch the havoc of it. These enormous chunks of concrete being pushed around and wrecked.
I suppose you're being kind of walloped side to side in your little mines.
Oh yes, yeah, evidently we're used to that. But so landing activity almost came to a halt or just to a trickle, mm-hmm. at that time, which must have been pretty hairy for the divisional commanders ashore, wondering if they were going to get enough supplies to
Everything's
keep going.
Coming by hand and by landing craft,
yeah,
I think,
right.
At
Yeah. But then after that, we settled down into a sort of routine clearance minesweeping in the channel until the breakout from Caen after that. And then we were employed, all the other... We were the only flotilla of moored mines, minesweepers left in support of the shore operations, and we did minesweeping. As the armies advanced, we did minesweeping along the coast, past Havre, Bordeaux, and way up the coast like that until they got to the borders of Holland, and then we were detached.
So in effect, you were supporting the Canadian troops as they moved up the coast?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. To make sure that just as soon as they got to an area where there was a port, that it would be possible to run ships into that port, and there wouldn't be any to shorten the lines of communication so that they wouldn't have to haul the stuff up from farther back.
There's a port in Belgium, I've forgotten its name, the one that was so important.
Zeebrugge?
No.
Ostend?
In Belgium?
Yeah.
The one that the Germans tried to get at the Battle of the Bulge.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
God, I hate it when I forget things. Anyway, that particular port, that it was supposed to be a godsend for the Allies. That it would relieve. It would be the first major port.
That's right.
Relief.
Yeah.
Did you mine?
Yes.
Was there any extra amount of mines that had been laid by the Germans there? Because it was a very important port.
That's right. Oh, no, there were quite a lot of mines along that coast. In fact, there were big minefields along that coast. But many of them were very old, so that a lot of the mines had disappeared.
Rusted away, I suppose.
Just broken away in gales for the most part. Yeah. And a lot of them would be swept very barnacly. Some so much so that they probably wouldn't have exploded anyway, but there was a fair amount of new mining, too.
Would you find yourself mining British mines, say, that had been laid to try and block off channels?
No, that came later. We were employed in, when the armies had, the battles had moved up to the eastward, and there wasn't much activity, enemy activity in the channel. We were then employed sweeping Allied minefields, mm-hmm. that had been defensive the minefields had been laid.
Well, that was well after victory, I guess.
Well, yes, before VE Day, but when channel activity had pretty well died down. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, I stayed with the flotilla until, I guess it was early 1945, March 1945. In the meantime, I'd switched ships. My own ship had been sent back for refit, so I'd swapped with another captain, and he'd taken the Caracat home, and I stayed on to another ship. Mm-hmm. Until March 45, by which time activities had died down pretty well, and it was becoming fairly routine, so I went back in the ship for refit. Mm-hmm. Which was a pity in a way, because I missed quite an interesting operation, which was into the Bay of Biscay coast of France, where there'd been a bit of a... I guess this must have been probably March 45. The Germans were still occupying the west coast of France, and there was some thought of another assault on the Biscay coast. But this had come to nothing. By the only really operational or minesweeping in enemy waters that we did, I suppose, after the armies had got up towards Belgium and Holland, was into the Channel Islands area, where we did a sweep in there again with the idea of a possible assault, but it was abandoned.
What about in the Baltic at all? Was that in British?
I don't think... No, there never was any assault in there, so...
Well, I'm thinking just straight mine sweeping.
Yeah, so, well, you didn't...
I guess at this point, the way you didn't sweep this for the sake of mining...
No.
...for assault, wasn't it? Yeah.
No, I don't know whether there was any mining in the Baltic. Probably was. But if so, we were never involved with it. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I came back for refit in March, and then I went back again with the ship. And by then, we were just doing sort of routine minesweeping of the whole of the English Channel pretty well, just cleaning up. This was after VE Day. Mm-hmm. So just cleaning up all the mines that were left from both German and Allied minefields.
Mm-hmm. Because of your ties to the East, did you volunteer for the Tiger Force?
Oh, yes. Well, everybody did, of course.
Yeah.
Most people. And then we were released by the RN and came home in August, I guess it was. And I was appointed to a frigate which was preparing to go to the East. To the west, the east, mm-hmm. for the Pacific War.
What was the name of the frigate?
The Antigonish.
How far did you get before the war ended?
Oh, well, I didn't. The VJ came along, and so that was that.
Mm-hmm.
But she was transferred to the west coast, and the war mentality still prevailed. To the degree that we were sailed from Halifax, if you please, on Christmas Eve 1945, the first post-war Christmas, which was, looking back on it, it was totally bizarre. but that was still the mentality then.
Rather absurd, isn't
it? Oh, quite absurd, yeah. Quite absurd. So anyway, we chugged our way around to the west coast.
Well, what would that, what shape had the Navy taken at this point?
Nobody quite knew what shape it was going to take, although the aspiration was to have a complete navy.
With aircraft carriers?
Aircraft carrier, cruisers, destroyers.
But had a lot of men been demobbed?
Oh yes, oh Lord, yes. Yes, mm-hmm. You see, the navy was then settling down to a peacetime navy, mm-hmm. and I think the number that was fixed at that time was something around... maybe around 10,000, I think it was, officers and men. And NATO hadn't come along then, and the role of the RCN wasn't at all clear. But the desire of the Navy was to retain a Navy that was a kind of all-purpose Navy, mm-hmm. with one carrier, possibly two cruisers, and two or three squadrons of destroyers, and a few frigates. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it shaped up. We
But how did one stay in the Navy afterward? Did you sign up again, or did you...
No, what happened was, you see, it was obvious that the peacetime Navy was going to be considerably larger than it had been before the war. Mm-hmm. And very few regular RCN had been recruited during the war. The war was fought largely with the reservists. Mm-hmm. And so, in order to make up the numbers of required for the peacetime Navy, a great many reservists were transferred to the regular Navy, yeah, and became RCN from RCNB or RCNO.
I can remember talking to an Admiral Hibbert in town. He said that of the group that he served with before the war in the 30s, a good 50% of them were casualties because, yeah, of their age groups, so you've got a great deal of... You have to have an influx of people.
Right.
You can't maintain what you had before, can you?
And the Navy were very sensible. They transferred reservists into all ranks from commander down, so that you had a rank and age pyramid, mm-hmm, that would allow for normal promotion in the various age and seniority levels. Mm-hmm. And so I was very fortunate in that, having been an acting commander, R&R, I was transferred as a confirmed commander, RCN, because of my age. Mm-hmm.
This is something the Army didn't do, and they had themselves...
Well, the Army transferred all these whiz kid boy brigadiers as generals, and they were badly blocked for quite a long time.
It wasn't until the 60s, or late 60s, early 70s,
So, the Navy hierarchy were very wise and sensible that way. And this caused a good deal of resentment and jealousy among the more junior, regular pre-war RCN people and wartime RCN people who found themselves being junior to transferred reservists. Mm-hmm. One can understand it very well, but as a policy, I think it made more sense than to promote people who were really too young for the more senior rank. Mm-hmm.
Even though their war experience, I think, is worth...
Well, not necessarily worth much more, because I think many reservists were pretty experienced. Mm-hmm. And so there it was, and...
You found yourself in command of the...
No, I found myself, my first job was headquarters, Deputy Director of Plans to then Captain Horatio Nelson Lay.
And one guesses where his mother and father, or how his mother and father got it. Yes.
And he was Director of Plans. And this is my first headquarters experience, my first staff experience of any kind.
In Ottawa,
yeah, so... It was quite difficult. It meant 5 o'clock instead of going home. I then had to spend until sometimes 2 or 3 in the morning for trying to teach myself what I hadn't known before.
Well, is there such a thing as Staff College for Naval Officers?
Oh, yes, sure.
I found myself quite ignorant in this area, but could you go to this? Or were you, it was available to you?
Well, yeah, but...
You're older than most it would have been going to, I should think.
Yeah. Yes, a bit. But at that time, the then Chief of Naval Staff didn't think much of formal staff training. Mm-hmm. He thought you ought to be able to do this kind of thing without staff training.
Had he had staff training himself?
Yes, he had been to a staff college. Mm-hmm. So perhaps it hadn't been a happy experience. Yeah. Because we had a few vacancies in the Royal Naval Staff College at Greenwich. And we also had a few vacancies at the RCAF Staff College in Toronto, but we had no staff college of our own. Yeah. And we even sent one each time, I think, to the Army Staff College in Kingston.
Mm-hmm. None but, to the Camberley one in England, or okay.
Well, no, only the Army, our Army went to that. Yeah. And so there I was pitched into this job, and I couldn't at that time ask for a staff course. It wouldn't have been expedient because of my age and rank.
Wasn't there something called senior staff?
Oh yeah, that that was a UK thing. Mm-hmm. We never had anything exactly like that, though. It was something similar. Yeah. But anyway, we lived in Ottawa. In the meantime, we'd gone back to Victoria when the anti-British went round there, and then my wife had come out and we'd found a place in Victoria. And then I was transferred to Ottawa, and transferred to the RCN, transferred to Ottawa. And we didn't quite know what was going to happen, so my wife stayed in Victoria until she got fed up with that, and bought a car, a Chev. Very, cars are very hard to get then, of course, there were hardly any being made. Mm-hmm. And drove out to Ottawa with our one-year-old son, which was quite an epic.
That had to have been an epic. Yeah, Canada,
yes. So then we set about looking for somewhere to live. Mm-hmm. And my wife was very bright. This was November. And first snowfall, she went around, oh, well, this came a little later, but she went around asking the grocery stores if anybody knew where there was a house to rent. And the little grocery store on Elgin Street said, well, there's a house there that somebody's just bought, and they have an attic which is partially converted to an apartment. Mm-hmm. So my wife went down, rang the bell, and the woman came to the door, and she said, is your attic rented? And the woman said, well, we haven't got an attic apartment. So Troy said, well, I think you have, because the grocery told me that you had. So the woman said, well, as a matter of fact, I've only just moved in, and we bought the house unseen. Let's go and have a look. So they went up and had a look, and there was the attic apartment. So, it was pretty crummy, but it was somewhere to live, so we moved into that. And then we wanted somewhere to put the car, and so the first snowfall, my wife went around looking for a garage where there weren't any car tracks.
You got an awesome genius wife, though.
Indeed, yes. And so she knocked on the door and said, it looks as your garage isn't being occupied. Can we rent it?
That's your kind one.
Yeah. So we got on very well with the owner of the house, who was an Air Force, he was an Air Force group captain.
Which would be roughly equivalent to your rank, wouldn't it?
No, I was senior. I was a commander then, the group captain was equivalent to captain. And the only time we had slight differences when they had a little girl about a year older than my son, and they used to fight furiously, these two. And the only other occasion was the electric hot water heater didn't have a thermostat. Mm-hmm. Then you could switch it to either low, medium, or high. And sometimes if I was in a hurry, I'd switch it off to high, and that'd forget to turn it back. The next thing you knew, the water was boiling, and you turned the tap on, and it took a long time before the steam wore off and you got a little water. We stayed there for a while. It was handy for the office until we saw an ad for a small house on the outskirts of town. We wrote in for that, and we got it. And sometime later, we were talking to the landlord, and he said, we asked him, he said, why did you pick us? You must have had hundreds of applications. He said, sure, I had hundreds of applications, but yours happened to be the first one I opened. So that was another bit of luck.
Well, how did you find the social world in Ottawa, or was there a social world?
No, there wasn't much of a social world.
There had been pre-war, I know that.
Oh, yeah. But we were newcomers to the place. For quite a while, the only sort of social life we had was with other naval people. Mm-hmm. Until we moved into this little house where we got quite friendly with the people next door.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Oh, not too bad.
Good.
Let's turn that off.
Victoria, I was sent down to a planning meeting with the Americans. There was a good deal of preliminary planning going on then between the two nations for American-Canadian cooperation in air defense and that kind of thing. This was pre-NATO. Mm-hmm. And so I went off down there and scouted. We were going to be about a couple of weeks anyway, so I phoned my wife and suggested she come on down. So she tried to get road maps, but nobody had road maps then, and nobody in Ottawa knew much about how to get to Washington. She was told, well, the best thing to do is to go down to Morrisburg and cross over in the ferry and then drive down next day, which she did. Still no maps, but people said, oh, it's not very far, you take highway so-and-so and go on down.
I left at 4:30 in the morning.
So she drove and she drove and she drove and she drove.
We meet him at 6 o'clock at the Shoreham Hotel, and being a good wife, I said, all right, I'll meet you at 6 o'clock. 10 minutes out, I think.
Having driven about 500 miles.
Very good.
So keep on being told, oh, Washio is just that away, not very far.
It was awful because it was late November, mm-hmm. pitch dark by the time I got into Washington. Hadn't a clue which way to go. Four lanes each side, which I'd never encountered. This was in 46.
Mm-hmm.
And when sailing forth, I get right out of the traffic, stop at a garage, and they redirect me back into Washington. And I got onto that. Have you ever been there?
Yeah.
Oh, well, you get into an awful circle. And I asked the taxi driver which was my way to go. And he said, on the left. Well, if it was, and so our cab sank on the left, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just almost shut my eyes and did it. And went round and round and round, always in the wrong...
Wrong way.
No, in the wrong lane, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And I was nearly in tears by the time I was through. I had no lunch. I had breakfast about 6 o'clock, I suppose. That's all I had. And there we were, stuck. I kept seeing the Shoreham Hotel, went round and round. There was a very nice young man with an open car. And he said, gee, honey, you're a long way from home. And I said, you've got to believe how far. And I said, I can't go round. I'm stuck. He said, don't worry. I'll fix it. So he got out of his car, and he held up all the traffic on the bridge and got me a car. He was marvellous. And today I blessed him.
In the meantime, I'd
told
the Shoreham people that my wife was coming down and they should change my booking to a double room instead of a single. And so we were there 2 weeks in a very nice room indeed. And then when I left, I presented the bill and I looked at it and without thinking, I said, oh, you haven't gotten the wife on here, you're still charging me a single. So the man said, oh, was that your wife?
Oh, used to this kind of
this was the nature of
the naval officer.
Precisely. Yes. They never suspected anyone as nice as a wife would be done.
Anyway, I worked at headquarters as the director of plans for a couple of years.
For the extra, for the double room?
No, no, he never believed that he was my wife.
I didn't know
that. No, I mean, so anyway, it stayed in Ottawa, and we lived in this funny little house just outside Ottawa, as it was then. And
it had been built as a
double garage and then converted. Mm-hmm. But very agreeable. We enjoyed that very much. And then I was...
the barbecue we had here. But,
oh, God.
What a terrifying... Have you ever barbecued a pig?
Yes, actually we have. The suckling pig, yes. Yeah.
Well, these friends and ourselves, mm-hmm. we thought we'd have a suckling pig party.
Mm-hmm.
So, Gal and I sallied forth with the children stuck in the back of the car. It was way into the 90s. We hadn't a clue where to go. And we drove for miles, and we kept going up these jacket-looking places, you see, and looking half-witted at the end, and said, have you got a suckling pig? And the wretched farmer looked as if we were dotty. Well, I'd forgotten how far we'd been with this long way, whole afternoon. Finally found someone with a suckling pig. And he said, yes, you could have one, but have to bring it back in the car.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we looked at the children who were then screaming. We looked at ourselves and we were very hot and sweaty. We decided we'd send the husband back to get one. So Tony and Paul had to go back a couple of days later and came back with this screaming, suckling pig in the back of the car. It was quite a party, I might say. We didn't get it cooked quite right or quite long enough, and the party finished at about 5 o'clock in the morning. It was a great party.
Mm-hmm.
By which time all the guest rooms were plastered, waiting for this wretched pig which wouldn't cook.
But it was hilarious. God, we had fun.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we tried to cook it outside on a spit.
Enough heat?
And there wasn't enough heat generated, you see, so...
Started it in the oven.
Yeah, for a little, but not nearly long enough. We should have cooked it completely in the oven and then sort of finished it off and sort of sizzled the skin on the spit outside.
Oh,
but anyway.
We had a lot of fun there.
Was it mostly naval friends?
Oh, by that time, I think we had a few other friends there. I'd met some Army people and one or two Air Force people.
It was a mixed bag, right?
That sounds a nice, comfortable social setting as opposed to the really stiff formal.
Oh, no, I was very relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, there wasn't the formality of pre-war service life by any means. That had just been... You see, in all three services, so many of the people were ex-reservists.
Mm-hmm.
And hadn't been conditioned to the rigidity, social rigidities of the pre-war services.
Which is fascinating in themselves, but very impractical.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, so that. Do you rather miss that?
Which?
The formality in the.
Oh no, the formality was. Post-war, it wasn't stultifying, or it wasn't bothersome. What formality there was quite agreeable.
Mm-hmm.
What I do think is a shame is that the calling stopped, because that helped so many of the wives.
Yes, but I think if you had been a wife in Ottawa, your calling would have taken up your entire day. You'd have to.
Oh, it did.
Yeah.
But I returned 250 calls from Marine Shearwater. I missed one. And the girls never let me forget it. She lived in Ottawa, and she'd never let me forget it. She wasn't in the phone book, and she didn't give me her address. My husband was at sea, and she'd never forgiven me. She always said, "You're the one that sent my call." But it helped a lot, though, didn't it? It did.
Oh, yes.
I think it did.
And it was the pattern of the times. It wasn't regarded as a...
wasn't a chore at all.
A chore, I don't think. People got to know each other a little better, instead of living in little cliques.
And you socialise between ranks as well, instead of stratifying yourself. And
especially on Magnificent. We really broke it down on that one, didn't we?
Mm.
Well,
that came a long time later, though.
Yeah,
yeah, a long
but, time. But in the mean, 49, as pointed to the Nuke coach, was destroyed, and we moved down to Halifax.
Had you been sort of striving to get another...
No, I was just taking things as they came, and... trying to get myself conditioned to the ways of the peacetime Navy.
Mm-hmm. Did you find yourself kind of out of step, or was it something you easily acclimatized yourself to?
Well, it took a lot of learning, mm-hmm. No question about that. And at that time, immediately after the war, there was still a little bit of... cautious walking around each other, perhaps, between the old CN and the transferred ex-reservists.
Mm-hmm.
It took a few years before the ex-reservists really became absorbed and regarded as a true part of the Navy.
Yeah. Was this true as well of the new graduates who were coming into the Navy? They felt this difference between...
No, I don't think so, because... a new graduate coming into the Navy has a certain inborn caution about his superiors,
mm-hmm.
and is really more concerned with his own affairs rather than trying to sort out who was an old RCN and who was a turnover reservist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably all the more senior people smelt pretty much alike to him, to the young sub-lieutenant,
mm-hmm.
who recently graduated. But anyway, we went to the destroyer, and we were at sea a fair amount. We were in company with a carrier or one of the cruisers. And that was the time of the mutinies in 1949, the spring of 1949, down in the West Indies, which was an unpleasant and uncomfortable experience.
Did your ship go part of that?
No, we were lucky. There was a certain amount of rest and rest throughout the whole fleet, but neither my ship nor the companion destroyer, the Haida, actually had mutinies. It was a time when the RCN didn't really quite know what its role would be, what it existed for, and what to prepare itself for, what kind of a navy it was going to be, so we did all sorts of things. I think probably from the point of view of the more senior people, it was a case of just trying to shake down into a homogeneous service, absorbing the newcomers, finding themselves settling down into peacetime routines,
mm-hmm.
peacetime attitudes. The first senior officer I had on that cruise was a chap called Gus Miles, Commodore Miles. And he had the dual role of being the senior officer of the squadron and the captain of the carrier. It wasn't a very good arrangement, but it was a small enough group that I suppose didn't matter.
Mm.
But on our way down to the West Indies, we had been doing exercises off Bermuda, and the tribal destroyers didn't carry that much fuel. And so we had to refuel, and we had been lent a small Royal Navy tanker. And in those days, we still fueled from astern. Mm-hmm. And the other ships fueled, and I was the last one, and it was starting to blow up for a real gale. And so we latched on, and we were heading into wind, and the other ships detached and went off on their way south towards Bermuda, and getting farther and farther away, and the wind was getting worse and worse, and the sea was getting worse and worse, and we were urging the tanker to boost up the pressure and get the oil into us so we'd get away. And finally, the hose gave up, and it parted at the coupling, stood up like that, and sprayed this heavy brown fuel all over the ship. We were covered. It was running down off the aisle deck over the sides, and even the ensign staff right after, covered in oil before he got it shut down. And so there we were, this stuff running all over the place. People on the bridge had it all over their clothes. So anyway, that was that, and off we went. And we joined up again with the Magnificent, the carrier, during the night, and we were stationed off her beam. And in the early morning, first light, I was watching, I saw Commodore Miles come out and take a look at us, and then he went back in, came back out with his binoculars and took a closer look. And then he went back in, and by and by, the signal lamp started to flash. And all it said was, "I'll inspect your ship on arrival in Bermuda." So there it was still blowing, and we only had 2 days. I must say, he left us alone, because the first thing we had to do was to wash off the fuel oil with kerosene, and then wash off the kerosene with ordinary suji, with soda and water, and then paint. And it was blowing, it was raining, it was wet. So we arrived painted, but with the paint still wet. And sure enough, as soon as we had moored in Bermuda, off Commodore Miles came with his staff officer, came on board, walked around the ship, never said a word, went down to the wardroom, had a drink, chatted, went back again, never said a word. So he'd just wanted to see what we were going to do about it. And we did what he expected us to do. Mm-hmm. Let's just do something. If we hadn't done it, he'd have had plenty to say.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, you didn't get... nowadays, you get what they call a Bravo Zulu, which is the code for well done. Well, in those days, you were expected to do these things, and nobody was going to pat you on the back for doing what you were expected to do. So then there was the miserable business of the mutinies, and this led to the Mingy Commission, which consisted of Admiral Mingy, the naval representative, Brockington, and our pal.
Which one? Hercombe?
No. The bachelor chap had a boat, and the lawyer. Oh, he was and chairman of the Maritime Commission later on.
Oh,
Louis Audet. Mm-hmm. Louis Audet. And it was really very good. There had been attempts to cover up by the then Chief of Naval Staff, the Navy, to try and sort of brush the thing on, under the table, but this couldn't be done. It had become too public. And there was an attempt to get the Royal Commission that investigated it to whitewash the thing. But Odet in particular was having none of this, and everything was exposed. Which was really a very good thing, because although it was humiliating for the Navy and deeply distressing for the Navy, and some of the things that came out did not reflect credit on naval officers or the way things were being done in the Navy, but it was very cathartic and salutary. The reaction, I suppose subconscious, almost instinctive reaction throughout the Navy was, well, this isn't good enough. We've got to snap out of it and pull ourselves together. And that's what happened. From then on, the Navy gradually got better, gradually more professional. A lot of the criticism had been that some of the old RCN were too much aping the ways of the Royal Navy,
mm-hmm.
and were affecting certain sort of attributes and attitudes of British naval officers, and this was resented. Oddly enough, they didn't resent people like myself, who still had a horrendous limey accent there at that stage, because it was genuine. Mm. And as professional seamen, the fact was accepted.
But was there still the interchange between the RN and the RC?
No, there was very little. Very little after all. But it was the born Canadians who had trained with the RN and then ate RN ways that they resented. But lots of things like that, and some lack of professionalism, and not quite knowing where we were going. But it made a big difference, and from then on the Navy really never looked back until Hellyer came along and became competent and professional to a degree that earned the genuine respect of our allies. It was a good time to be in the Navy. Very good time.
Okay, so on that note, since we're almost out of tape, I better end the interview for today.
Okay, sure.